We're going to put it up right now.
Thank you.
We're actually going to take a few moments, have a minute of silence, and then we're going to say this prayer together. Prayer. God, please lay aside everything I think I know about addiction, alcoholism, the big book, the 12 steps, this workshop, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with all of these things. Help me see the truth. Amen.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Brandon.
Brandon.
Welcome back. Hopefully you guys didn't eat too much so that you'll be falling asleep on us. We've been in the middle of the second step. We've been doing a lot of talk of this thing that some people call God. And I'd like to read a little thing out of 365 Dow. Tarek made reference to the donkey that we all ride, and the title of this is called Donkey. Dismount your donkey at the summit. Some places in this world are very hard to climb, and the people use animals. Each person can only ride one, and each animal might have a different name. But riders go up the trail in different orders, and they discuss their varying opinions about their experiences. They may even have conflicting opinions. One traveler may think the trip thrilling. Another may find it terrifying. And the third may find it banal. At the summit, all the travelers stand in the same place. Each of them has the same chance to view the same vistas. The donkeys are put to rest and graze. They are not needed anymore. We all travel the path of the Creator. The donkeys are the various doctrines that each of us embraces. Why does it matter which doctrine we embrace as long as it leads to the summit? Your donkey might be a Zen donkey. Mine might be a Tao donkey. There are Christian, Islamic, Jewish, and agnostic donkeys. All lead to the same place. Why poke fun over others at the name of their donkey? Aren't you riding one yourself? We should put aside both the donkeys and our interim experiences once we arrive at the summit. Whether we have climbed in suffering or in joy is immaterial. We are there. All religions have different names for the ways of getting to the holy summit. Once we reach the summit, we no longer need names, and we can experience all things directly. So, that's kind of where we're at in the steps is right now is we're all sitting here. The prayer that we said is to lay aside the name of my donkey so that I can come back. I may decide that I want to still use the same donkey later on. But for this experience that we're in the middle of, I have to put it out to graze and pasture so that I can have an experience with whatever's going on now. Because if I've got a God that's defined and is dogmatic and it's real clear what that God looks like, I have cut myself off from being open-minded to a new experience, which is exactly what this prayer calls for. Is those things may be necessary, but let's pick them up when it's time. Jim. Okay, so turn to page 50 of your big book. The second full paragraph, I'm just going to touch on it. In our personal stories, you will find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the donkey that got him to the summit. And it's what it's saying to me. Okay? The fourth paragraph at the bottom. Here are Tarek and Brandon, worldly indeed. That means that we're of the flesh. We are not gods. We are not floating around in spiritual world. We're actually here in the world with you. Brandon and Tarek flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves and to take a certain attitude toward that power and to do certain simple things, such as the steps, there has been a revolutionary change in our way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of total failure of my human resources, I found a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into me. This happened soon after I wholeheartedly took the steps. Once confused and baffled by the seeming futility of existence, Tarek and Brandon show the underlying reasons why they were making a heavy going of life. You heard some of mine last night. You'll hear Tarek's tonight. Leaving aside the drink question, at 9 years sober, at 5 years sober, we can tell you why living is so unsatisfactory. But we can also show you how the change came over us. So when we can sit up here before you and are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of our lives, we present a powerful reason why one should have faith. Now, there's a word in that last sentence that I am convinced the majority of the people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous did not see. It is the word consciousness. Because if this program is simply about believing in God, this book would be very short. It would say, believe in God, thank you. But it's deeper than that. And hopefully what we've shown you this morning and last night is that it is far deeper than that. Because simply a belief in God is simply inadequate. Because if a belief in God was adequate, priests and ministers and rabbis would never come to AA. But guess what? Priests and ministers and rabbis come to AA. So it must be more than a belief. And it has been our discovery that it is the consciousness, the co-communication, the co-creation with that power that is the most important fact of our lives. This is the sixth sense that the book talks about. This is the fourth dimension that the book talks about. It is that ability to have an understanding and relationship to where I interact with this thing. I don't read about it. I interact with it. We've got a recipe book in front of us. I can read the recipe book. 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 I'm eating nothing. It's not until I take the recipe book and I apply the information into it and I cook something with that, that I have an experience that's tangible that I can eat. And that's what we're going through these steps to understand, is the steps will take us to that experience with the consciousness. And it starts out a little bit fuzzy. There's some older guys in here, so they remember the days of the rabbit ears on the TV, right? You know, you would come and you would get that TV with the rabbit ears just perfect, and it would be tuned in, and the screen would be crystal clear. You could see what was on the TV. And then, like, 2 days later, nobody's touched the antennas. but the screen's kind of blurry and it's kind of getting fuzzy and it doesn't make any sense. So then you got to rework on getting those rabbit ears just right to get the screen kind of clear. Well, that's how God is for me, is that God is constantly transmitting. God is constantly sending a signal. The problem is, quite often, Brandon gets his rabbit ears a little bit twisted. Maybe I take them off. Maybe I turn them off. Who knows? So I have to constantly seek. I have to constantly try to tune that in so that I can get the signal. And that signal is the consciousness. That is what happens. Turn to page 53. So we've already hit the bedevilments on page 52. On 53, the first full paragraph. Logic is great stuff. We liked it. We still like it. It is not by chance that we were given the power to reason, to examine the evidence of our senses and to draw conclusions. It is one of man's magnificent attributes. We agnostically climbed, would not feel satisfied with the proposal which does not lend itself to a reasonable approach and interpretation. Hence, we are at pains to tell you why we think our present faith is reasonable, why we think it is more sane and logical to believe than not to believe, why we say our former thinking was soft and mushy when we threw up our hands in doubt and said, we don't know. You see, because when I became an alcoholic, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, not something somebody else created, something I created, I could not postpone or evade. I had to fiercely face the proposition that either God is everything or God is nothing. God either is or He isn't. What's my choice to be? What's your choice to be? Because if God isn't everything, then you have a limited God. If God is everything, well, then He can help you. It can help you. She can help you. Whatever your current conception is. So, you have to challenge yourself. You have to look at that constantly. Page 54. First full paragraph. We found, too, that we had been worshipers. What a state of mental goose flesh this used to bring on. Had we not variously worshipped people, sentiments, things, and money in ourselves? Anybody do any of those things? The girl, the job, the truck, the car. And then with a better motive, had we not worshipfully beheld the sunset, the sea, the flower? Who of us has not loved something or somebody? How much do these feelings, these loves, these worships have to do with pure reason? Little or nothing. We saw at last. Were not these things the tissue out of which our lives were constructed? Did not these feelings, after all, determine the course of our existence? It was impossible to say that we had no capacity for faith, love, or worship. In one form or another, we had been living by faith and little else. Faith in me, faith in money, faith in her, faith in the job. So it's really starting to challenge you in this chapter of the people that think that they don't have faith in something to prove that you do. Imagine life without faith. Where nothing left but pure reason, it wouldn't be life. But we believed in life, of course we did. Can you prove to me that you exist? How do you know you're alive? Maybe you're not. Maybe this is all just some crazy little dream that you're in the middle of, that you're going to wake up from someday. How can you prove it? You can't. But you're experiencing it, so there's something here, right? So there are sometimes things that we experience that we can't explain to somebody else other than just say, well, I know I'm alive because I'm here. But how do you know that you're here? We cannot prove life in the sense that we can prove a straight line is the shortest distance between two points, yet there it was. Could we still say this whole thing was nothing but a mass of electrons created out of nothing, meaning nothing, whirling onto a destiny of nothingness? Of course we couldn't. The electrons themselves seem more intelligent than that. At least so the chemists said. Hence, we saw that reason isn't everything. Neither is reason, as most of us use it, entirely dependable. In fact, after you've been through a fourth and a fifth step, you can identify pretty clearly that your reason is actually quite flawed. And that your perspective on life is probably a little bit screwed up. But until you get to that point, you can't experience that. So, the second full paragraph on page 55. This is starting to indicate to you where I believe you can find God. And clearly where they think that you can find God. And where, if you really boil the essence of every major religion down to its essence, is this is what it tells you. Actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. Let's just say, and those are the things that block me from that essence, that thing that I feel. But in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than myself and miraculous demonstrations of the power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. I finally saw that faith in some kind of God was part of my makeup, just as much as a feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down inside ourselves. In the last analysis, it is only there that God may be found. It was so with us. What do you want to hit proper attitude? Hmm? What do you want to hit this?
Mm-hmm. Attitude.
You want to hit now?
Go ahead.
Okay, so... Later on in the book, it says that with this attitude, we cannot fail. And it's confusing because they reference an attitude, but you can't find where what that attitude is. But here's where the attitude is. It says, we can only clear the ground a bit. If Tarek and my testimony helps sweep away preconceived ideas and opinions, enables you to think honestly, and encourage you to search diligently within yourself. Then, if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. So there's three parts to that. Sweep away prejudice. Open-mindedness. Think honestly. Honesty, and search diligently within yourself, willingness, then come on. You too can create a consciousness with this power that will keep you sober. But it's more than belief, it's more than faith. It is consciousness. It is an interaction. It is an experience that you cannot describe in words. It just happens.
Thanks, B. You know, early on in the book, when they tell you they're going to give you precise, clear-cut directions, I mean, it can't get any more precise and clear-cut than this. They tell you exactly how to find this power. They tell you where you're going to find the power. They even tell you when you're going to find the power. They tell you in the last analysis, it is only then that God may be found. I'd like to read something to wrap up this step. There is a basket of fresh bread on your head, yet you go door to door asking for crusts. Knock on the inner door, no other. Sloshing knee deep in clear steam water, you keep wanting a drink from other people's water bags. Water is everywhere around you, but you see only barriers that keep you from water. A horse is moving beneath the rider's thighs, yet still he asks, "Where's my horse?" Right there under you. Yes, this is a horse, but where's the horse? Can't you see? Yes, I can see, but whoever saw such a horse? Mad with thirst, he cannot drink from the stream running so close by his face. He's like a pearl on the deep bottom, wondering inside the shell, where's the ocean? His mental questionings form the barrier. His physical eyesight bandages his knowing. Self-conscious consciousness plugs his ears. Stay bewildered in God and only that. The last place we look. You know, the Hindu have this story of, I believe it's Brahman, who's all of creation, and she plays this game, or he plays a game where he separates himself into an infinite number of pieces, and he plays a game with each piece. Is he gives each piece amnesia, and the game is to see who's going to wake up and come to claim their inheritance, which is being a part of that whole. And this is part of this work will wake you up into the interconnectedness of life. The more I apply myself to the 12 steps and use those as the modality by which I know my Creator, I have more and more evidence presented to me that proves to me everything's connected. You know one thing that shows me how connected we are, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit. When I listen to a fifth step, and I've heard the same fifth step many, many times, there's not much difference in our fifth steps, which shows me how similar we are, how our paths are so similar. That's just one layer of how life is connected. And we also fall victim to the delusion that if I compartmentalize my life, that if I act this way in this area over here that's well hidden, at least I think it is, and I am dishonest over here, that it's not going to bleed into every area of my life. But it always does. You know, I made a comment earlier that relapse happens for one reason, which is you are not in fit spiritual condition. And if you go a little bit deeper, you will always uncover dishonesty. You'll always see the dishonesty. And it's because we don't see the connectedness, the interconnectedness of everything. And so that completes the second step. And we're going to move into how it works. It says our stories, mine and Brandon's stories, disclosed in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. That statement in the big book is the most misquoted statement in the book. When people get up to a podium or they sit down to tell their story or share their experience, they typically will say something along the lines of, I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. But that word it, what is that? What is it? Is it talking about drinking? Is it using drugs? Is it my personal relationships, my emotional natures, my living situations? And so the book gives a very clear-cut instruction about telling our story. In a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. So as a sponsor, it is incumbent on me, my responsibility when I sponsor men, that I share with them, if you ever get asked to share your experience, this is the format. You're going to describe in a general way what you were like. You're going to discuss the surrender and what happened and how the steps came into view. And then you're going to talk about God and what that's done with your life and how you deepen your contact with God. And preferably talk more about that than any of the other stuff. But what do we always see many times? Someone talks about what drinking was like, or using was like, for 40 minutes, and at the very end they get sober and everything's fine. To me, that's not a very attractive way to carry a message of hope, of depth, and of weight. Last night, Brandon got up to that podium. He talked about the steps and God and perspective and how these things have evolved and moved and how they've grown in his life. I mean, he gave you just enough of what he was like so you guys identified with him. That you understood that he was alcoholic, like some of you are in here. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Well, there's a condition there. You're ready to take certain steps if you've decided what we want. Are you taking the certain steps to get rid of some consequences? To get the wife back? To get some money back? To get some relief? Or have you decided you want what these people in this book are talking about? Do you want that way of life? Some of us will try to hold on to old ideas and the result is nil until we let go absolutely. There's another reference to the set-aside prayer and setting aside old ideas. Remember that we're dealing with heroin and crystal meth and cocaine and alcohol, etc. Cunning, baffling, powerful. You're going to hear people say the only step that references alcohol is the very first one. The only step that references cocaine and all mind-altering substances is the very first step. That's only if you're looking at the short form of the steps. Clearly, we are in step three, and they're talking about alcohol in the big book. Later on in the ninth step, it's going to say, remember, at the beginning, you agreed to go to any extreme for victory over alcohol. They're once again bringing the connection back to this is about having sanity around the first drink. It has something to do with that. Without help, it's too much for us. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Now, in the original manuscript, it used to say, you must find him now. Half measures availed you nothing. You stand at the turning point. I want to talk about it. The turning point is rooted in genuine surrender. And the best way to understand surrender is to understand that it's a pure gift. You're asking yourself, well, how do I know if I'm surrendered? Watch your feet. Watch your feet. If you're moving through and you're not resistant and you're not defiant and you're following directions, I see that as being surrendered. You're like a samurai in battle, and you realize you've been defeated and you've been overwhelmed. You've met your match. You lay down your sword. I'm done. That's surrendered. Another paradox, right? We can't use that out in the real world to win. I mean, they don't teach that in the real world. Well, they teach us to grab all we can out of life. Win, win, win at all costs. And so how it works is read in a lot of meetings, and I just went over a few sections of it. But in actuality, right now, you're in the third step. You're in the third step. And so page 60, the description of the addict and alcoholic, step one. So the doctor's opinion all the way up to page 43. The chapter to the agnostic, step two, and our personal adventures, drunk and sober, have been designed to sell you three ideas. A, that you're alcoholic and or addict and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism and or addiction. And C, that God can and will if he is sought. If you're not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away. That's what the original manuscript said. Very, very in your face. There's no fluff around it. I understand why they had to fluff it up, but I always like to read it that way. It makes a lot of sense. So if I'm sponsoring you through the 12 steps and we're sitting at my house or we're sitting at the church before the home group, this is step three, section A. We can't go any further unless you can convince me based on your memories and your experience and what we've done in the book up to this point, convince me that A, B, and C are true for you. Because look at the next paragraph. It says, being convinced of A, B, and C, you're now at step three. So why go on? Why move forward if you're not convinced of A, B, and C? And what you need to be convinced of is the first two steps. That your first step says you're going to get high again and you're going to drink again. And it's rooted in a state of hopelessness. And you're willing to believe that perhaps a power greater than yourself can recreate your life. That's what we're talking about here. So step three, section A, being convinced of the ABCs. So step three says we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? So this question is answered on the next page, page 62. And so step three now has a second part to it, section B. Step three, section B. Tarek, do not go any further unless you're convinced that your life run on your ideas and your belief systems, what I call self-will, can hardly be a success. If your life is remotely successful based on what you've been doing with it, you would not be at the Bridges of Hope. Okay? And so, what does it mean to live a life of self-will? And that's what the next two pages are going to be about. So we're going to ask you to do something. As we go through these pages, I want you to reflect back over the last 48 hours. The last 48 hours, and let's see how this has shown up in our lives. On the basis of running my life on my ideas and belief systems, I'm almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. Who here had some really good motives over the last 48 hours but found themselves butting heads with somebody? You're all liars. Who here has tried to live by self-propulsion in the last 48 hours? Let me describe this to you. Self-propulsion is where you don't have any path of consideration available to you. You're just going. You're going, you're going. There's no thought, no premeditation. You're like a pinball in the pinball machine. You're just going, going, going. That's what living by self-propulsion looks like. Has anyone here been an actor who wants to run the whole show? You've been just trying to, you know, if this person would do this, and you would do this, and this group over here would do this, we'd end up with a good outcome. If you guys would only do as I say. Okay, those of you that are in leadership positions, do you got any of that going on? If only my arrangements would stay put. If only people would do as I wish, the show would be great. Everybody, including myself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. Here's the deal. In trying to make these arrangements, I may sometimes be quite virtuous. I might be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, I may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, I am more likely to have a varied trait. Who here thinks they're people pleasers? Any people pleasers in here? I want you to line up everyone that's pleased with you right now. Does not exist. We're not people pleasers. We're approval seekers. We seek approval. It has nothing to do with pleasing other people. We're selfish and self-centered. We seek approval because our validation must come from the external world. At some point in our lives, we told ourselves a story, and the story was, Tarek, if you're ever to feel anything on the inside, it's going to take something on the outside to make it happen. So I lived a life of seeking validation in the external world. Money, job, women, houses, friendships, clothes. That validated me. And because of that, I'd find myself in these positions where in order to get what I want, I got to be considerate, patient, and generous. But on the flip side, I'm very mean and egotistical and dishonest to get it. That's a horrible place to exist. Existing in that way requires I have to have an anesthetic, a in order to really move through that experience. Well, what usually happens? The show doesn't come off well. Tarek begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself even more and become on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious as the case may be. Still, the play doesn't suit Tarek. Admitting that he may be somewhat at fault, he's sure other people are more to blame. Tarek becomes angry, indignant, which means I get angry because I think I've been treated unfairly, and I become self-pitying. What's my basic trouble? Here's the deal. Am I not really a self-seeker even when I'm trying to be kind? Am I not a victim of the delusion that I can violently twist to pull away satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage right? If I only manage well. Is it not evident to all of the rest of the players in my play that these are the things that I want? And do not my actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Am I not even in my best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? You know why I find myself sometimes still, it's not nearly as bad as it used to be. Sometimes I find myself the producer of confusion rather than harmony. And it happens for one reason. Let's imagine I'm sitting up on a stage. And I'm in this little amphitheater. And I have a box next to me. It's got a script for every person in my life that I engage with on a regular basis. And so out in the audience are all the important people in my life. And they know exactly how they need to act because I have the script for how they show up in my life. But what happens is I never send them their script. But I act as if I sent them their script. They're supposed to know how to act. And I find myself having to direct everybody because they've forgotten their lines. This is how we operate. This is why we have to have an anesthetic to deal with life. Page 62. So the authors of our big book are ingenious, I guess is the word I'm looking for. What if they had told us, what if they started page one with selfishness, self-centeredness? That we think is the root of your trouble. I wouldn't have stuck around if that was on page one. Yeah?
Done with the book. I'm not reading this shit.
It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called Cocaine Anonymous. So they spent 54 pages sort of talking to us about alcohol and drugs. Now they say, they get down to the root problem. This section sums up my problem when drinking or sober, when I'm high and when I'm clean. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of Tarek's trouble. He's driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. Tarek steps on the toes of his fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt me, seemingly without provocation. I throw my hands up and I say, man, what did I do? But if I take the time to look into the past, I'll find always that I made a decision based on self or ego, which has now placed me in a position to be hurt. This is pretty much what inventory is about. I can always trace my life situations that I think make me a victim to the decision I made in the past that has put me in a position to be hurt. And so after the book lays out your true problem, it gives you the greatest statement of hope. This is the best news you guys have ever received. You ready for it? Your troubles, every single one of them, are basically of your own making. You're not a victim.
Huh?
That's the best news you will ever receive. That means that the world does not have to change for Brandon and Tarek to be okay. These problems arise out of me, and I'm an extreme example of self-will run riot without a spiritual experience in my life, though I usually don't think so. Above everything. Brandon, what does above everything mean?
Like above everything? Above everything?
Above everything. Okay. Above everything, we addicts and alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must or it will kill us. Question. Do you believe your selfishness will kill you?
Hell yeah.
Okay. Well, God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of your selfishness without His aid. We've all had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we can't live up to them on our own, although we'd like to. Here we go. Neither can we reduce our self-centeredness or our selfishness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We have to have God's help. Do you believe you can be entirely rid of self with God's help? So, we've completed, as we've gone through that process, step three, section A, be convinced that A, B, and C are true using your own memories. Why, that's why they're true for you. Step three, section B, based on those pages we just read, and you looking at the last 48 hours, this is what we're up against. It's this type of selfish, self-centered behavior that will bring us back to a drink or a drug. It's a result of the unmanageability and the capacity that we lack to believe God can recreate our lives. All of that together, it's all moving at the same time. And so now we get to step three, section C, the decision. So many people in the meetings, when you hear step three, I hear two things, the prayer, or I hear, I turned it over and I took it back. When I hear someone say that in a meeting, I know they don't understand the third step. If the third step was about turning it over, the big book would be another page. It would say, God gets you sober, keeps you sober, have a nice life. Boom. That'd be it. But it's not. It's much more than that. We have to have a direct experience with this power. In order for this decision to happen, this decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God, we have to work steps 4 through 9 specifically. Why? Because those steps contradict the way each of us have lived life. Who in here wants to take a personal house cleaning before you get here? Who in here wants to tell all your deep, dark secrets to another person? Everything you've struggled so long to keep in the dark? Who wants to go to God and say, God, these are things about myself I find objectionable. I haven't been able to do a damn thing. Will you please help me? I can't help myself. Who wants to make a list of all the people you've ever harmed, all the money that you owe, and then go knock on all those doors and make all those phone calls and set up all those appointments and pay all that money back? Anybody in here want to do that before you realize your life's on the line? That's how the decision happens. That's how you make a decision. You want to turn money over to God? You want to turn your relationships over to God? Inventory your relationships. Inventory your finances. Go fifth step it with somebody. You'll discover some glaring defects of character around finances and relationships. You're also going to find that you've harmed some people because of your desire to control these areas. And you go set up those appointments and you make those amends. As a result, you have now turned over relationships and money to God. But what do you hear in the meetings? I'm turning it over. As if there's some magic button under this table that you show me when I'm like 5 years clean and sober, and it's been here the whole time, and that's how I turn it over, right?
But I think the whole thing, the whole third step to me, like, I can just imagine, like, God sitting up, say that there's a heaven above us, and He's watching us alcoholics. And He's watching us write these, He's watching Bill write these steps. And Bill's like, we're going to make this decision to turn our will over to the care of God as we understand God, right? And God's sitting up there going, fine, I'll let you think that you're actually doing something. But you don't think that this power that has the ability to invent the universe and do all this stuff can't make you do whatever it wants you to do when it wants you to do it anyways? But instead, we think that we do something through this step. We think that we actually, and God just says, that's cute. Just, that's fine. We'll let you think that you're making a decision to do what I can do whenever I want. The difference is that you become consciously aware that you're actually doing this. You're making a commitment that I plan to do the rest of this stuff. Because if you don't make that commitment to do the rest of the stuff, then you're just out there making promises that aren't going to ever happen.
You know, in my first 18 months, I lived these two pages. The only thing that changed about my character in those first 18 months was I became willing to do whatever I had to do to not smoke crack cocaine and drink whiskey. And so I sponsored a lot of guys, but I still treated women poorly. I still had no idea what it meant to have financial sanity. I took my family for granted. I didn't like to be by myself, and I was always exerting my ideas and belief systems on everyone, but in a much more blatant way. I lived pages 60 to 62, and at 18 months, somewhere around 18 months, I experienced the second surrender, which is to self, which is to these two pages of how we actually live. This is not talking of, this is not describing a person that's drinking. Page 60 to 62 actually describes someone that's sober without any alcohol in their body, in my opinion. And so this is what our problem is. That's why they're telling us the root of the problem is selfishness, self-centeredness. The alcohol and the drugs are just a symptom of this problem. And so in order to complete the third step, you make a decision. What is the decision? It's a contract. You're entering into a contract. The contract says, you know what? This power is going to do certain things, and I have certain responsibilities. The power will direct. My job is to show up and play the role I'm assigned. I'm going to act. The power is the principle. I have an agency for God. I am empowered to take care of God's kids, manifestations of a living creator, in my opinion. It will take care of me as if it's my father because it created me. It is my father. I will act like a child that's safe and protected. And then my job is I work for God. What I want no longer matters. I don't get a vote. My life's no longer my business. That is the decision you make in the third step. So be very careful when you pray that third step prayer. Because the prayer is just section D. Step three, section D, it's an affirmation of your decision. And so we're going to take a break. But when we come back, we're all going to say the third step together before we roll into inventory. All right, so it is a 20 after. Let's come back at 35 after.